Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Catherine Russ, who's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council on Economic Advisers as senior economist for international trade and finance. She is a faculty research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research, International Trade and Investment Group, and a research advisor at the Halle Institute for Economic Research in Halle, Germany. She has been a visiting scholar at the central banks of Germany, Portugal, and France, and the Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis and San Francisco, and she has a new report at Econofact, Will Steel Tariffs Put U.S. Jobs at Risk? Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Russ.
Thank you, Ian.
And today, of course, Donald Trump made good on his promise to slap 25% tariff on steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum, saying that the U.S. is suffering from unfair trade and that essentially we've been taken advantage of. He actually pointed to Australia as a country that we may be able to do something with. As he said, he praised them for the fact that we have a trade surplus with Australia. So it does seem to me that this is sort of an economic simpleton here. I mean, just because you have a trade deficit with some countries, that's a bad thing. If you have a trade surplus, that's a good thing. Is that how Donald Trump sees the world?
So the message from his Council of Economic Advisers in the Economic Report of the President, Chapter 5, actually presented a more standard view, I guess, of current account deficits or trade deficits that basically is macro conditions that drive these deficits. So if we happen to be recovering faster from the global financial crisis, for instance, then we can expect our trade deficit to grow. And if we're recovering more slowly than other countries, then we could expect it to decline. So his Council of Economic Advisers is right on target with this. The message that you hear coming from, say, Peter Navarro, the director of his National Council on Trade, for instance, some of the statements that his Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, has made, those do seem to have this more tit-for-tat kind of almost mercantilist view where trade deficits are unequivocally a bad thing. It means you're losing. And you definitely see that from some of the statements the president has made as well.
But he also, I mean, first of all, the thing that I find extraordinary about this is that China is supposedly the bad actor on the world stage, particularly with intellectual property, et cetera. And he railed against China. And then when he had a nice visit both here at Mar-a-Lago with Xi Jinping and then later in China, in fact, he recently said how well he was treated in China. So he seems to have laid off the Chinese. But doesn't this put America in the situation of being the kind of bull in a china shop? I mean, as far as I could tell, most people around the world were concerned about China's trade activities. But now surely the focus has been shifted off China onto the United States, and now the U.S. is the bad guy.
It's true. We've really, with this unilateral set of tariffs, we're really putting a wedge between the United States and then other countries who could be allies with us in trying to combat unfair trade practices or combat production subsidies and other types of non-market behavior in the global economy. So this is shooting ourselves in the foot in a way.
Well, he did go on to attack Germany today. He was talking about how countries don't treat us fairly and went on to say many of the countries that treat us the worst on trade and on military are our allies, singling out Germany. So, again, China gets off the hook and Germany gets punished. Germany has a pretty successful economy. They actually are opening plants here in the United States. Do you know what his beef is with Germany?
Germany does run a very large trade surplus. They also run a fiscal surplus at the same time that they contribute a bit less to defense than they have committed to under a NATO agreement. So I think that's the main... So again, if you think that having a trade deficit with a country is bad, and them having a surplus with you is you know, somehow them beating you or being unfair to you, then that would explain this lashing out at Germany. Again, I don't think that there's an economic basis for that point of view, but politically that seems to be the talking point there. With the NATO commitments, I'm not sure if they've made any progress on that this year, but that's kind of an ongoing issue, and it's more of an issue to be handled between departments and ministries of defense and departments and ministries of state and foreign affairs. It's a more delicate issue with some historical roots. So, but that seems to be one of the baseball bats that we're knocking our allies with right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Catherine Russ, who's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council of Economic Advisors as a senior economist for international trade and finance. She is a faculty research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research International Trade and Investment Group and a research advisor at the Halle Institute for Economic Research in Halle, Germany. And she has been a visiting scholar at the central banks of Germany, Portugal, and France, and the Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis and San Francisco. And she has a new report at Econofact, Will Steel Tariffs Put U.S. Jobs at Risk? And to answer the question that you posed in your article, Catherine, it's pretty clear from just about every economist who's looked at this is that in order to boost a few jobs in the steel and aluminum sector, and Donald Trump, of course, had some steel workers and aluminum workers on display with him at the photo op in the White House today. For a few thousand jobs, we'd be losing, many, many more thousands of jobs. That's the economic reality here, isn't it?
So the sectors where companies use steel as an input and also use inputs made of steel, the jobs in these industries do outnumber the number of steel-producing jobs by about 80 to 1. So that is the case. The Economist today, their March 8th edition, cites a new study by the Trade Partnership where they suggest that possibly as many as 33,000 metal-making jobs might be created under these tariffs, at the same time that 179,000 metal-using jobs our jobs in metal-using industries are destroyed. So those are some numbers according to their model, the first ones I've seen specifically analyzing this particular type of scenario. We also had steel tariffs imposed under the Bush administration. Job losses under those tariffs estimates range from between 24,000 and 200,000 jobs. So not out of line with this estimate you're seeing today by the trade partnership. And then estimates for how many might have been saved, the range I've seen is up to 10,000, so still a lot less than the number of jobs that would have been destroyed in the steel-using industries. So there's a real possibility there could be some net job loss. In addition, a lot of the decline in employment we see in the steel producing industries are due to innovation. So the vast majority of the decline in employment is because we can make more steel with fewer people now due to technological advances. There's been some really great academic research on this topic by Jan de Locker that's come out in our premier journal, the American Economic Review. But that means that even if we save jobs now, it's probably just a short-term thing. That over time, the only way that you're going to long-term keep more steel jobs is to tell companies to stop innovating.
Well, it would seem that might be what's got Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell to go public, and they've been very uncritical of Donald Trump in ways that have mystified a lot of people and wondered why they weren't standing up for, there are all kinds of reasons, shall we say, why they should have spoken up about many things that have happened so far. But unusually, they both spoke up against Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum. And do you think that has something to do with the statistics that you just told us? In other words, they're afraid that Trump's actions are going to spoil the economy ahead of the 2018 elections.
These are really smart men. I'm sure they're aware of that. But I think what they may also be committed to is a rules-based system. And what's happened by invoking this national security excuse that really doesn't hold up very well in the numbers is the United States, with this move, is starting to undermine the whole principle of a rules-based system governing global commerce. And I think they realize where that could lead. The other thing that might be deterring them are the retaliatory tariffs by our trading partners, in particular Europe, possibly also China. Some of them are targeted directly at Speaker Ryan and Senate Majority Leader McConnell's home district, or home district for Speaker Ryan and home state for Senator McConnell. So it could be the threat of tariffs on Harley-Davidson motorcycles and Wisconsin dairy. It could be the threat of tariffs on Kentucky bourbon that also have caught people's attention.
So when you touched on, as you just did on Catherine Russell, on the national security aspect, and that is the sort of basis for this ruling, my understanding is that, simply put, the national security dimension here is that if we were at war, for example, unless we have enough steel capacity and aluminum capacity at home, we couldn't, during wartime, ship it by sea, because you have to ship heavy steel by sea, and it takes a while, so that you need a domestic capacity in wartime. And that's the sort of framework that they're operating under. And, of course, it made no sense to punish Mexico and Canada, because the argument doesn't work. There's no ocean between the U.S. and Canada or the U.S. and Mexico. So is that why he's had to sort of recalibrate? Now, of course, he's taking another bite at the apple in terms of leverage over Canada and Mexico, saying that, you know, we'll let you off the hook over this tariff, steel and aluminum tariffs, but we've got to renegotiate NAFTA.
Yeah, so Secretary of Defense Mattis wrote in a letter that's online for anyone to see to Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross that the defense requirements for steel constitute only 3% of U.S. production. So the national security argument, just by the numbers, is pretty thin. Also, most of the steel that we import is from these allies, as you say, so Canada, Europe, Japan, Mexico, South Korea. So the national security argument is incredibly thin. I think the reason for going the national security route is to avoid an independent review by the independent United States International Trade Commission. So if you're to file petition for some other type of trade safeguard on steel or aluminum, then you would normally have to go through USITC. And because they're an independent agency, they give a much more unbiased review of whether or not protection is warranted or legal under WTO and U.S. trade laws. Whereas this, because it was done under the Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1964, goes through the U.S. Department of Commerce, which the secretary, of course, is part of the cabinet. It's not at all an agency that's independent from the White House, although they do have very credible internal, like excellent career staff and analysts who work on different issues. But this particular review could not really, in any sense of the word, be considered independent.
But that didn't stop Donald Trump from saying today that steel and aluminum are the bedrock of our defense industrial base. So he's certainly using the argument, even if it makes no sense, both in terms of what Secretary Mattis is saying and in terms of the whole idea that we don't have, you know, we can't depend upon shipping steel from overseas during wartime.
So the rationale for this move has been shifting over time. I don't know if it's shifting in a particular direction and will land in a particular place or not. Today it sounded like the rationale was to bring steel capacity up to 80%. There's no statement in Secretary Mattis's letter that suggests that a capacity utilization rate of 80% is necessary for national defense purposes. In addition, before that, the rationale was to punish China or to bring to bear some consequences for China's support of its own domestic steel industry. Well, our unilateral tariff will not hurt China. Only 3% at most of our imports are from China. It varies 2 to 3%. Now, almost all of those imports from China are already subject to anti-dumping or countervailing duties, so we already have special tariffs on a lot of steel coming from China. So the rationale keeps shifting each time it seems to be rather questionable. So really it seems to be a case of domestic politics, that it's simpler to say, oh, we're going to put on a tariff, instead of saying, okay, what can we do for these communities that are suffering from shifts in our economy? What can we do to strengthen our social safety net, to strengthen infrastructure, to strengthen educational opportunities, training, apprenticeships, to help give people a better chance in today's economy where technology is advancing so quickly?
Well, since the whole thing makes no sense, and as we've discussed, it looks as though a lot of it has to do with Donald Trump's incredible ignorance about basic economics, where he thinks that if you have a trade surplus with a country, then that's a good thing, like Australia, who import more American goods than they export to the United States. So they're good, but Germany's bad because the opposite is true. That seems to be the way he thinks. But there's also the influence, of course, of Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross and Trade Representative Lighthizer. He's been a lawyer for aluminum and steel companies. And most of all, Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross made his fortune in buying distressed American steel companies and selling them at enormous profits to overseas buyers. So there may be that, maybe a simple dimension there that there are certainly, at least Wilbur Ross might well get a windfall out of this. But what also happened today and seems to have gone under the radar is that a number of countries, including major allies of the United States, Japan, Canada, and Australia, along with Mexico, Vietnam, New Zealand, Chile, Malaysia, Peru, Singapore, and Brunei, signed what is being called the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership. And it's as though they're trying to put together the TPP that was one of the first things that Donald Trump eviscerated when he came into power. And, of course, you worked on the TPP during the Obama administration. And it's been widely seen as a massive gift to China, because the whole purpose of the TPP was not just a trade pact, but it was also a way not so much to contain China, but to have the neighborhood organized in such a way that China would be forced to follow the rules of the road rather than make up their own rules, which is what they're doing now. And it also would have had a massive dimension in terms of China's internal governance. The fact that they've been able to turn the clock back away from economic and democratic opening with more freedom and transparency, turn the clock back with Xi making himself dictator for life and cracking down on all democratic openings, etc., would indicate that this, again, is not only tearing up TPP being a gift to China, it has also set back the idea of China moving in a more democratic direction. So it's been a catastrophe. So do you think the deal that was signed today by the vestiges of TPP are going to bring it back? There's even some talk that maybe at some point or other the U.S. will come to its senses and rejoin the TPP.
So I would hardly call it the vestiges of TPP. I mean, this is 11 of 12 members coming together under really uncertain odds and without, you know, the biggest player in the original 12 to make a stand, again, for a rules-based economy. And I agree with you. I think that is us shooting ourselves in the foot, leaving the TPP. It was encouraging to hear statements from Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin over the past week, who apparently has engaged in some high-level discussions of the U.S. possibly engaging in negotiations with these remaining TPP countries, again, possibly re-entering the agreement. The president himself, when he was in Davos, actually said he could entertain the notion, and he said this in a very vague way, not at all a promise, but just a thought that, you know, it needn't be the disaster that perhaps, you know, on the campaign trail, candidates really tend to hate trade, but then once they're governing, they tend to find it much more helpful and convenient to growth. So I find this move by the remaining 11 extremely encouraging and exciting in terms of hope for a rules-based system, for a system based on U.S. values of free and fair trade, trade that could protect consumer privacy, e-commerce, could tackle the non-market behavior of state-owned enterprises, which is one of our biggest beefs with China. So even though China isn't a part of it, those countries in the Asia-Pacific region adopting these standards really throws down the gauntlet there and says, look, this is the standard we think that people should be following. And it makes a statement at a time where China's trying to negotiate its regional comprehensive economic partnership with seven of those same countries and then other countries in the region as well, that would lack the teeth. It would lack enforceable labor standards. It would lack enforceable environmental standards. It would lack a number of the values that are really key to American ideas of prosperity and fair commerce. So today's move by those TPP 11 was very exciting, and Japan has made it clear the whole way through that they're keeping it warm for us. If we want to think about joining again, you know, they have left the door open so that it would not be hard to put that deal back together again, or I imagine even tweak and improve it if people felt like that was, you know, necessary. But it's still there for us. And interestingly, Japan has not spurned, but been reluctant to engage with us in a bilateral negotiation, which the administration has been pushing since day one, since Vice President Pence went over and visited Japan early on in the new administration. So I think that they're really showing some leadership over there for rules-based commerce, and what they've done, it should be a hopeful sign to everyone.
Well, I guess just ending on a hopeful note, I guess we can say that Donald Trump won't last forever, so presumably sanity can return at some point. And I thank you very much for joining us, Catherine Russ.
Oh, thank you, Ian. It was an honor.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Catherine Russ, who's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council of Economic Advisors as senior economist for international trade and finance. She is a faculty research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research, International Trade and Investment Group, and a research advisor at the Halle Institute for Economic Research in Halle, Germany. She has been a visiting scholar at the central banks of Germany, Portugal, and France, and the Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis and San Francisco, and she has a new report at Econofact, Will Steel Tariffs Put U.S. Jobs at Risk? We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the damage that Trump is doing to women all around the world following his decision to impose the global gag rule along with defunding the UN Population Fund.